I'm Jean Marie Laskus. I'm a journalist. I spent my career helping Americans understand the lives of other Americans. Coal miners, gun shop clerks, staffers in the White House mailroom. In my new podcast, Cement City, I tell the story of an entire town. A dying town that you have absolutely no reason to care about. But trust me, you will. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Barry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a focused look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the country. Buckle up, folks, because we're in uncharted territory. Today on Deadline is diving into a first-of-its-kind spectacle as Donald Trump becomes the first president ever, former or sitting, to appear as the defendant in a criminal trial. Here's the latest. Opening arguments began Monday in a case in New York City that's expected to last about 6 weeks. The case against Trump stems from allegations that he ordered his former attorney, Michael Cohen, to pay adult film star Stormy Daniels $130,000 to keep quiet about an alleged affair between the two of them. The payment was made in the crucial days leading up to the 2016 election. Trump was charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records, but he's maintained his innocence. Cohen pleaded guilty to 2 campaign finance charges over the payments after telling a grand jury that Trump authorized the hush money. Trump first said that he wasn't aware of the payment to Daniels, and then later said Cohen was paid a legal retainer to negotiate a non-disclosure agreement with Daniels over, quote, false and extortionist accusations. While speaking to reporters last week, Trump placed the blame on his accountants for how they recorded the payments. I was paying a lawyer, and we marked it down as a legal expense, some accountant. I didn't know, Trump told reporters. Mark it down as a legal expense. That's exactly what it was. And you get indicted over that? As both sides battle, how do you find a jury to weigh in on the once most powerful man in the world? We're learning it's not easy. To share more on the impact the trial could have on jurors, Jorge Vela, a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor in Austin, Texas, joined Odyssey.
So what do we know about this jury selection process? I imagine it's probably that much more challenging than a typical case, or no?
Absolutely. Any trial attorney will tell you that jury selection is the most important part of the trial, especially for the prosecution. What people need to know is that any verdict in this case needs to be unanimous. That means all 12 of the regular jurors must agree whether he is guilty or not guilty. If even one of those jurors disagrees with the other 11 jurors, that means we will have what's called a hung jury, and it will result in a mistrial. The mistrial will be a win for defense in this case. And so in this particular case, jury selection is so important because one wrong juror that is left on there by the prosecution could result in disaster.
Now, you are a criminal defense attorney. Tell me who from the defense attorney's side, who are they looking for? Who do they want to see on the jury?
That is a great question, but I have to flip it around. This process is known as jury selection, but what you are trying to do as an attorney in this process is actually get rid of the bad jurors. Attorneys know this more as jury elimination, not jury selection. What you are trying to do as an attorney for either side, whether it's the prosecution or the defense, is trying to eliminate jurors that you think you cannot convince to your side, that they are just impossible, that they've already made up their minds because they have preconceived notions about either the law of the case or the individual that's on trial, in this case, Donald Trump. Now, everybody has an opinion, I think, if you haven't had your head under the sand for the last 6-7 years about Donald Trump. And so in this case, the perspective from these attorneys are not who do I want on this jury, is who do I not want on this jury. And that is ever more important for the prosecution because, again, it only takes one juror to say I'm not convicting in this case because for whatever reason I like Donald Trump, or they're being too hard on Donald Trump, or they're treating Donald Trump unfairly and I just disagree with these charges, for it to result in a mistrial, put humongous pressure on the prosecution as to whether or not they're going to retry this case because of all the resources that have gone into it already, and whether or not they're even confident that they can get a conviction if they retry him. So again, really difficult, I think, job for the prosecution in this case.
So this trial is significant to the general public in a way that most are not. Why is publicity such a problem when we talk about selecting a jury?
Absolutely. Great question. All I have to do is point out to what happened yesterday. I mean, imagine yourself as a juror that has been selected in this case, and the entire world is watching this case. And now you are in the middle of this divided cauldron of a country that we have right now. A man set himself on fire yesterday outside of that courthouse. That, imagine being a juror on this trial and then thinking the lengths that some people will go to either send a message in support of Donald Trump or against Donald Trump. You never know. I mean, these individuals, we cannot forget, have families. It's not just the individuals that are on this trial. It is their families that they are thinking about. And so you can imagine that they might be terrified that by making a decision to convict Donald Trump, it may attract violent acts by extremists that are in support of Donald Trump and could affect their ability to be fair in this trial. I mean, we've already seen one juror that was dismissed because she was terrified that her information was made public. That speaks volumes.
What can we expect to see as the trial progresses?
I think that you're going to see a lot of delay tactics from the Trump team. I think that you're going to see a day, every single day, full of objections, start and stop. It's going to be a frustratingly slow, grinding process. We heard the judge say that this trial is anticipated to take about 6 to 8 weeks. I think one of the central issues in this case, and it's going to be something that we see on Monday, is going to be how much the prosecution is going to be allowed to get into Trump's criminal or other bad acts, is what we call them. There's going to be what in New York is known as a Sandoval hearing, more commonly around the United States is known as a 404B hearing. And that is when the prosecutors are not normally allowed to introduce character evidence or evidence of other bad acts of the accused. Defense obviously doesn't want anything to come out regarding the E. Jean Carroll case, the other trials that are happening in Georgia and in D.C. regarding the January 6th riot. Prosecutors, on the other hand, are trying to show motive, intent, plan, knowledge, modus operandi by Trump. They want to get in the E. Jean Carroll lawsuit to show basically a pattern of conduct by Donald Trump. And also, something that the judge has already ruled on is the introduction of these tabloids from the around the same time that all this was going on, and it was to show the cover-up. At the same time, defense is arguing, look, you cannot introduce these headlines because it's overly prejudicial to their client. And so that's going to be the back and forth. We're going to see a lot of that throughout the trial. And so I think that defense, though, the entire time, we're going to see them trying these delay tactics, which we've already seen. We saw a last-minute change of venue, motion filed that was denied. I think we're going to see that all throughout the trial.
This is Jean Marie Laskus with the podcast Cement City. So there's this election coming up, a big one, and one guy's been indicted. People are talking voter fraud. Democracy itself is on the line. Sound familiar? Well, this isn't that election. This one is in Denora, Pennsylvania, a dying town in the middle of nowhere, where I bought a house and stayed for 3 years. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
The opening arguments were delivered Monday, with New York Attorney General Alvin Bragg's office starting by laying out the facts, saying that the payments to Daniels were made at the defendant's discretion and that he, quote, did it to influence the election. This was a planned, coordinated, long-running conspiracy to influence the 2016 election to help Donald Trump get elected, Matthew Colangelo, a member of Bragg's team, told the jury. It was election fraud, pure and simple. At the end of his opening statement, Colangelo alleged that Trump continued to pay Cohen back in 12 monthly installments during his first year as president, totaling up to $420,000. Trump's team countered in their opening statement that the former president wasn't paying Cohen back for anything other than his legal fees. Would a frugal businessman, would a man who pinches pennies, repay a $130,000 debt to the tune of $420,000? Trump lawyer Todd Blanche asked the jury. Blanche went on to paint a picture of revenge, saying that Cohen, Daniels, and even Bragg had it out for Trump and were looking for anything that they thought would get back at him. To share more on the start of the trial, Patricia Hurtado, who was in the courtroom covering the trial for Bloomberg News, joined Odyssey.
Tell us a little bit about what was going on in the courtroom, the mood in the courtroom, and perhaps more importantly, the demeanor of Mr. Trump.
Well, Mr. Trump had to confront a past that the prosecutor said he tried to bury basically 8 years ago when he was running for the presidency the first time. There were these salacious stories about an affair with a porn star and that the National Enquirer had gotten tipped off about it. And this comes right on the heels of the Access Hollywood tape, where we can remember that Trump was caught on tape on a hot mic boasting about his conquests with women. And the prosecutor said today that the Trump campaign was in basically a tizzy, trying to figure out how to do damage control, that the Republicans, even National Committee, even considered replacing him with another candidate. So they rushed to buy and bury the salacious story of this porn star, Stormy Daniels, and pay her off with $130,000 hush money payment.
So the prosecutor, as I understand it then, Patricia, is painting a much broader story than the actual indictment, which is technically about falsifying, allegedly, Mr. Trump's business payments to Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, also known, I guess, in some circles as his fixer. He's painting, the prosecutor, they're painting a picture of what? The beginnings of a scheme to, in effect, steal the election?
That's correct. They're calling it campaign interference, that what Trump did was basically buy and bury any bad news, including other stories. Apparently, there was also the 10th testimony or an account of a woman whose name is Karen McDougal, is a former Playboy model who also claimed to have had an affair with Trump in 2006. So that the campaign was running around trying to bury these stories and put them out of sight so no one would hear about them. But what was very curious today is Trump's lawyer basically had a different spin on events, and he said, spoiler alert, there's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy.
Let me ask you this, Patricia, as a reporter in that courtroom, and I don't know if you feel comfortable speaking for other reporters in the courtroom, maybe you do, maybe you don't, but has it occurred to you, is it processing for you the truly historic nature of what you were witnessing in a courtroom in Lower Manhattan, New York City, that what is going on there is something that up until now probably was never even imagined?
Well, I think most of us could never imagine a former president of the United States on trial for crimes. And the thing that's extraordinary to me is I've covered that courthouse for years, decades. I've covered murderers and killers. Harvey Weinstein went on trial in the exact same courtroom 4 years ago. And when he got arraigned, I was in the courtroom when he was brought in. And it was an unbelievable moment to realize, oh my God, there's Donald Trump. Oh my God, he's the defendant. Oh my God, he's been indicted. And that was unbelievable. And then it got to be kind of common. I was even down in Miami when he was arraigned on the mishandling of classified documents case. But this now, I was sitting behind him on Friday. We were invited back into the main courtroom after the jury was selected. And I was sitting about 10 feet behind him, and I had a very close look at him. And it was really extraordinary to think that's Donald Trump on trial, sitting at the same table where Harvey Weinstein sat. I mean, it's unbelievable to see this process. I mean, I guess we could say that this is justice in action, that if the justice system, the criminal justice system, works this way, then it really works.
Here's the biggest kicker. With the 2024 election inching closer by the day, Trump is finding himself sitting in courtrooms instead of campaigning for a second term. As Trump spends more time fighting his legal battles, he may find it difficult to fight his political opponents, which could cost him come November. ABC political director Rick Klein joined Odyssey to give more information on what effects this trial could have on Trump's re-election bid.
So there's a new AP survey that found just 1 in 3 Americans thinks the president did something wrong in the hush money case. And there's a lot of ways to read that, but I'm kind of reading that as there's just not a lot of interest here. Like, it's almost as if everyone is Trump legal problems out. And I'm wondering if you get that sense or how you're looking at things.
Yeah, I think the poll asked about whether people thought he did something illegal. and that's the number you're citing. I could be wrong. I don't mean to jump off by correcting you, because I still think it's striking. And if people are putting this in kind of its own bucket and say, well, maybe he did something wrong, but it's not a broken law, that could change perceptions. There's also polling, as I'm sure you've seen, that shows people considerably less likely to support him if he's convicted of a serious crime. So those things cut in different directions. I think of the various criminal charges he faces, of the four major cases, this is probably the weakest legal case, and therefore probably makes for the weakest political case as well. So it's odd that this is where the attention begins, and this is where Donald Trump's going to be spending so much of his time over the next couple of weeks.
You know, it's going to impact how often Trump is able to go out and campaign. But does that really matter? Because these two candidates are so well known. I mean, there's been questions of, are there even going to be debates this time around? I mean, how much does the traditional campaign circuit matter?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and a great point. I mean, first of all, Donald Trump likes to complain that he's stuck in court. There were lots of times over the last couple of months that he went to court, even though he didn't have to be there, just so he could complain about and raise money off of it. He's having a campaign event this weekend in North Carolina. He has mostly been doing weekend rallies anyway. He'd rather not be in court all day, but he also has a huge microphone when he steps out of that court and talks to the cameras. So everyone's covering it. Everyone's there. He's got plenty of ways to get his message out. And his message of being persecuted is nourished by this case and the fact that he's in court. So, I don't think it's actually changing the trajectory of the race, as frustrating as it might be to him and his strategist that they have to spend as much time where they are.
While it may be his legal troubles or any other factor at play, one thing is certain. Trump is losing steam to President Joe Biden. A new national poll from NBC News found that Trump is leading Biden 46% to 44%, a margin that was 3 points larger just 3 months ago. You might be thinking that the results of that poll actually seem positive for Trump, but it's only one of several identifying this trend that's leading towards Biden. For example, The Hill's Decision Desk HQ, which compiles results from national polls, also has Trump's lead over Biden slimming. As I record this, it's sitting at 45.3% to Biden's 44.4%. With Trump still awaiting a ruling from the Supreme Court over his presidential immunity, as well as a Georgia trial and two federal indictments, he could see his lead slip even more as he's forced to trade speaking events and posts on social media for the witness stand. This show is produced by Joe Heedy, Christy Strauser, and Myron Kaplan. And by me. I'm Lauren Barry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.
This is Jean Marie Laskus with the podcast Cement City. So there's this election coming up, a big one, and one guy's been indicted. People are talking voter fraud. Democracy itself is on the line. Sound familiar? Well, this isn't that election. This one is in Denora, Pennsylvania, a dying town in the middle of nowhere, where I bought a house and stayed for 3 years. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.